Hello and welcome to the Philanthropy Australia podcast. Our guest is Dr. Matthew Beard, a moral philosopher and writer and content producer at the Ethics Centre. He has a PhD in military ethics and has published a number of papers and books on a variety of topics, including moral injury and post-traumatic stress disorder. Matt's a regular in print, radio and TV, discussing ethical issues. He's taught philosophy and ethics at the University of New South Wales in Canberra and the University of Notre Dame, Australia. Matt also produces an ABC ethics podcast for kids called Short and Curly. In March, Matt was announced as the new program director of the Vincent Fairfax Fellowship at the Cranlana Centre for Ethical Leadership. We began our discussion looking at ethical leadership in the age of COVID.
Let's start with a very kind of broad and topical question around leadership in the age of a pandemic. How much do the ethical parameters shift in that circumstance?
So I think we need to get clear on probably what ethical parameters mean. Certainly priorities will shift based on the situation and what is at stake in the situation. So there are things that will be considered in, you know, quote unquote, ordinary times to take on a higher priority, which will take a back seat during the pandemic. If we take, for example, organizational leadership, the performance of staff, you know, we might hold our people to a particular standard of excellence in terms of the way they go about their roles. In circumstances where there is not just organizational stress, but widespread social and global stress, not just placing pressure on the ways in which we're working together and the ways in which we're operating, but people's individual well-being, their sense of safety, you know, their psychological health, we lower the standards and we deprioritize that relative to other priorities. So, but that's the act of leadership inherently, is to respond to what is in front of us and to articulate and recognize what is most important in a given situation and then figure out how to rally people around that in order to move towards some kind of common goal. And in the case of the pandemic, the common goal has been communal health and communal well-being. That's what we've all been working towards. And in a sense, there's been a real widespread rallying together where we've not competed in the same way as we often do. You know, different organizations, different sectors, different groups of society, we all have this, you know, really clear, tangible, common goal. Like, people are looking at case numbers. They were, you know, in the early phases, we were talking so much about this curve that needs to be flattened, that was this collective effort. And it just really helped people zero in on some kind of common goal. I think that in some senses made leadership easier, even though the pandemic gave rise to an enormous amount of complications. Like, and I don't want to diminish those, but there was this central purpose, which everyone, this single number really, that everyone could be working for.
So from that then, now as we kind of emerge in some ways into this stage of the vaccination and some kind of recovery, how much do you think the dynamics of leadership are changed by the experience of the pandemic, now that the common goal is perhaps a little less fixed? Where does that leave leadership from here on?
I think it would be a real shame if what happened as we move toward a recovery was a very quick desire to put this in the past and to get back to the way things were, to get back to business as usual. There are lots of really good reasons why we would want to do that from a pragmatic, from an economic standpoint, and from a well-being and health standpoint. But in terms of the things that we've learned and discovered along the way, I don't think that leaders should be looking towards, you know, a really hard pivot back, you know, where we can suddenly focus on our organization and we can focus on competing rather than collaborating and we kind of de-emphasize the common good. I would argue that in a lot of ways, you know, the way in which organizations were thinking about their responsibilities during the pandemic, with a focus not only on organizational survival, organizational flourishing, but also on community well-being, the well-being of their people and the common good, that should be the default setting. You know, when we look at what we expect of leaders, when we look at what we think of ethical leaders, it's not just someone who has a really narrow circle of interests, all of which align with organizational interests and with the self-interest of the leader. It's someone who takes as a live concern, takes a duty of care for an enormous cohort of people and for the common good itself. And I think that when we saw successful leadership during the pandemic, that's the kind of model that we saw. And I think we ought to try to cultivate that and think about how we can cultivate that kind of a mindset without needing some kind of global emergency to get us there.
And what would you recommend in terms of the steps towards cultivating it and then ultimately embedding it in A, a leadership style, and also B, the organization?
It's a really good question. I think that there are a range of things that will start to get us there, and they work both at a systems level, at a cultural level, and kind of at an individual level. I think that individually, we all discovered during the pandemic, whether we were in a leadership position or not, we all recognized the actions of total strangers could have an enormous influence over our ability to live the lives that we want to live, to flourish, to go about our days ordinarily. If there was a large enough group of people who weren't going to abide by kind of social distancing measures in the early stages, that was like 80%, you know, we were told that this wouldn't work, that we would be dealing with, you know, a much more extreme version of the pandemic than we wound up dealing with. The corollary to that is that we can have an enormous influence over the well-being of people who we will never meet and who we will never see. And we need to find ways of keeping those people in mind when we are making decisions. You know, this is what philosophers call moral imagination, the ability to take a really broad sphere of concern in terms of the people who fall within our remit to influence and to care for. It's really easy to care for the people who are visible to us, who we talk to, who we have direct influence over. But what we've learned is that we need to go a step further than that. We need to be actively reminded of that, whatever those prompts are going to be, whether they be in process, in design phases, the way we're building projects. You know, there are processes like human-centered design that try to narrow in on some of these questions. But I think that there's a much more philosophical concern here, which is actually that we need to think of ourselves first and foremost, both as individuals and within organizations, as participating in a moral community, so that we see ourselves as dependent on the people around us and as obligated and bound by the people around us. And we should think of ourselves in that way, which means that we take a mindset of care and a mindset of constraint and restraint in terms of the way that we operate, so that we are quite careful about our footprint. I think at a cultural level, one of the things that needs to happen in order for us to do that is that we need to cultivate an environment where people are able to bring an identity that is not just, I've come into work and I've put on my work hat and my work mindset, and now I owe all of my labor and energy to this organization. And outside of that, I can be a citizen, I can be a member of my family, I can be a member of my community. But when I am here, my time is owed to the organization. I think that we need to allow people to bring all of those different aspects of their identity. They need to bring their citizenship. They need to bring their family identity, their community identity, so that we aren't by design kind of articulating, you know, who is our audience as an organization? Who are our stakeholders? As though we were also delineating the people who we care about and the people who we don't care about. I think we need a much broader mindset than that going forward.
That's an interesting view. And I suppose the thing that strikes me straight off the bat about that is that just even in the most basic manifestation of where we are now, the way that the vaccine rollout has been implemented is that we have older Australians getting certain kind of vaccine, younger Australians getting a different vaccine, but that in fact younger Australians, there's no real urgency for them. If you're under 40, you're probably not really thinking much about getting a vaccine. In a sense, we're actually creating, it seems to me, at some level, a community with quite different priorities around that health issue. Am I kind of misunderstanding that? And if I'm not, what's the consequence of that for the sorts of things that you're talking about?
I don't think that it's the case that we are creating a schism where different people are prioritized in different ways. I think that people, whether they're at the front of the line or whether they're further back in terms of wanting vaccination, we have a shared concern, but we recognize that there are people whose needs are greater than our own. And again, like, this is ethics 101, right? Like, if you can't recognize that there are sometimes other people's needs who trump your own, then there's some really basic groundwork to be done. Mm. And I think we've been quite comfortable with that, you know, there is concerns about how long people have to wait and the availability of vaccines in general and how that vaccine rollout process has been managed. There are questions about the actual practice of that. But the principle, both in terms of who has access to those resources first, which is really needs-based, and that's the way that most medical ethics works, is a kind of triage on the basis of need. That's not unusual. There were also in the early stages expectations that we as Australia should be at the front of the line in terms of having access to vaccines. But that was at a time when availability was really low, and there were absolutely other countries and other places around the world who had greater need of the vaccine than we did. And so that's where, you know, as individuals, we get it. We're like, yes, you know, the elderly person down the street, the person who's immunocompromised, like, yes, those people should be receiving the vaccine first. But then at a larger scale level, we have this expectation still that, well, we draw the limits of concern around our own polity, around our own fellow citizens. And it was very easy to say that, well, therefore, we should have access to the vaccine before other communities. And I think that was a lot of the concern around some of the bans in terms of travel to India as well, was what did that say about the way in which we conceive of a fellow Australian? What do we say in terms of the kinds of care that we extend, and how do we draw the boundaries on that?
I'm glad you went there, because it's an interesting point. And I was looking at it in the weekend papers about that tension between whether that decision, and, you know, it's obviously an act of leadership to make that call about the circumstances in India, whether in fact it is appropriate to characterize it as driven by racial considerations, or whether in fact it's actually a decision based around the medical circumstance. How do we navigate our way around those kinds of quite different perspectives?
Australia really has a lot of work to do in terms of having nuanced discussions about race. We are still caught in a kind of intention mindset, which is that racism is racist intent, which is when you actively say, people from a particular ethnic background, I think they are lesser, I like them less, I think their capabilities are less, or they are valued less, and I am going to act on the basis of that. Like, that kind of paradigm of racism still exists in the forefront of people's minds in a lot of respects. But the conversation has matured around racism since then. So it's not necessarily the case in saying, hey, there was an element of racism in the travel bans on India. To make that claim, it doesn't necessarily mean that the people who did that as individuals hold a particular perspective on people who come from India or people with a particular skin color. What it is to say is, firstly, that it is in its effect going to disproportionately affect people of a particular background. And secondly, that it's quite likely that some of the reasoning for that, whether conscious and intentional or not, it has been easier because for political reasons, for reasons of the ways in which we consider Australia to be, its heritage to be more closely connected with places like the United States and the UK, that the idea of flat banning flights was raised in the context of India, but wasn't raised in the context of the United States, for example. So I think the conversation is much more complicated and much more sophisticated than it is a question of saying, well, you know, the intent of this was racist, and therefore it was racist, or no, this wasn't racist because we didn't have racist intentions. We had these other reasons. We had these concerns of health. You know, we've seen this in the pandemic before, right? We know that when lockdown measures were put in place, that communities of color were more likely to be heavily policed. So there were more infringements found in communities that had higher populations of people of color. That's despite the fact that other communities that tended to be more white tended to have higher case numbers. You know, in Sydney, we saw a lot of cases emerging from the northern beaches and the eastern suburbs, but it was in Western Sydney that we saw a huge amount of, you know, infraction notices issued. You know, it doesn't follow from that that every individual who issued an infraction notice has some kind of, you know, racial hierarchy. But when we look at the consequences of that, you know, there's a really long history of the way in which policing is done in this country. There's a really long history of the way that immigration has been done in this country. And just because these decisions have been made with health in mind or with law and order in mind. Just because we have some kind of noble motivation doesn't mean that there aren't other factors that influence our decisions. You know, in many ways, that's the work of leadership, is to recognize on an individual level, what am I bringing to this that might be, whether I'm aware of it or not, obfuscating my decision-making? And on a larger scale, like, what are the forces at play here that might be pushing or influencing the outcome of my decisions? Even if my intention is one way, the outcome might be the other because of a range of systemic forces and cultural forces that I need to wrestle with and I need to be aware of.
So I want to pick up on a word that you referred to a couple of times a few moments ago, and that's competition and a competitive environment. Mm. What are the challenges that leaders have to confront when they're in a competitive environment? What are the kind of the ethical minefields that present themselves, and how are they different to those leaders who are operating in a more benign environment?
What happens in a competitive environment is that victory becomes a central value. So ordinarily, when we're thinking about the decisions and the things that orient our choices, the things we care about, you know, they tend to be pretty noble things. We care about truth. We care about honesty. We care about kindness. Like, those are the kinds of things that we tend to value. But when we introduce a competitive mindset, like, what it means to be in competition, you know, in one sense, is to kind of like put a value on winning. And that means putting a value on a particular outcome. You know, and once we've put a value on a particular outcome and there is something at stake in that outcome being achieved, and our achieving of that outcome requires, because competition is about scarcity, requires that someone else doesn't get that outcome, right? So we've immediately identified that winning for me needs to look like losing for you. So we immediately then are going to prioritize particular interests and particular needs in a certain way that doesn't necessarily attend to the fact that those people with whom we're competing might have other needs. They might have needs that have a greater claim in a particular circumstance. So that becomes the first challenge. But the second challenge, and to me the greater challenge, is that when a scarcity mindset and when a competitive mindset means that we are prioritizing outcomes, it can come at the expense of the process by which we achieve those outcomes. So we're more likely to cut corners. We're more likely to play fast and loose with some of the rules and norms. Some of the ethical considerations that need to be brought to bear, they tend to be viewed in a different way in a competitive mindset. It's not even necessarily the case that it's like, well, we'll get an advantage if we break the rules. We'll get an advantage if we do the wrong thing and get away from it. It's also that some of this stuff is slow. Some of it takes time, you know, to really carefully recognize the needs of different stakeholders, to really think about the potential side effects and adverse consequences of a decision takes time. And when we are in a competitive mindset, we're being first to market, where faster decisions, where faster outcomes are important, then suddenly the diligence and rigor with which some of those processes need to take place, that can get really cloudy. Those are the concerns of leadership. Is like, yeah, we exist in competitive mind spaces. As much as I would love, you know, for scarcity not to be a problem, sometimes it is. So then the work becomes recognizing when you're in that mindset, recognizing what the potential temptations are, and then having clear systems and clear competencies in place so that we can manage those. You know, I worked on the consulting project with Cricket Australia in the wake of Sandpapergate, and that's the paradigmatic competitive mindset, right? And so there are certain things that people wouldn't fathom that suddenly, when we're in this mindset and when this logic of victory takes over and we fixate on that, it's amazing how we can slip step by step away from the ways in which we would ordinarily make decisions, because there is this singular goal. It's like a moth to a flame, you know, that just slowly draws us in a particular way. It doesn't always happen. It is manageable, but we need to be alive to the risks that it generates.
So in that instance with Sandpapergate, what are we talking about in terms of, I mean, that is in many ways, whether you're a sports fan or not, represents probably the most heinous demonstration of what an Australian team has done anywhere at any time in search of a competitive advantage.
One of the things that has been happening, you know, like, again, we talk about competitive mindsets and we talk about pushing the edges of things because there is another value we're pursuing in terms of winning. Manipulating the ball, working the ball, has been something that has been part of cricket for a really long time. And there is an art to that. There's an art to ball management. And then there have been a range of different ways in which it has generally been accepted that ball tampering takes place. You know, so there is the use of certain lollies. You know, there are a range of different things that will happen that fall more into tampering than ball management. And so what that does when we've already kind of started to open up a space as being kind of, you know, gray areas or somewhat legitimate, is that then that logic of, well, hang on, they're already doing it, so there is no in principle difference between X and Y. You know, we start to open up different options. And I think that was a big part of what happened here, is that there had been a general relaxing of standards with regards to ball tampering. There was a heap of stuff that went on behind the scenes. But just as a kind of like, you know, what is one of the morals of the story is that we can sometimes feel like relaxing standards to a certain extent is okay because everyone does it and because reasonable people will still know where the line is. And you notice like Australian cricketers talk a lot about the line and knowing where the line is. It's never clearly articulated what that line is, mm-hmm. what that line is in regard to. And that's something that we see in organizations across the board, like what is absolutely by the book the right thing to do. There is absolutely by the book the wrong thing to do. Then there is this cluster of unregulated or informally regulated activities that fall within that, which is the vast majority of the stuff that we do. And there is a line that somehow determines where those things sit. And whether we have common agreement on what that line is or where that line falls, whether leaders and those who are custodians of an organization's, you know, ethical remit, its mission, its purpose, its values, whether they have any influence over how people draw that line or not, you know, all of these questions kind of fall by the wayside because we're quite comfortable that people know where the line is because we are inherently good and reasonable people. And we are inherently good and reasonable people. It's just that that is not a solution to the problem of making good ethical decisions in complex and high pressure environments. Like it's not a good and reasonable person test. It's so much more than that.
But that's the interesting thing, isn't it? That we understood almost instinctively where the line was in that case and felt that our national team had actually transgressed it.
Well, I don't agree actually that we could have clearly articulated what wouldn't have crossed the line and why this did cross the line, and why there weren't other activities that hadn't crossed the line or had crossed the line. Sledging is a great example, you know, like what counts as the line with sledging? And there are some infamous sledges that, you know, people will recount while they're having a drink or while they're watching a boring test match and they want to long for, you know, the more entertaining days. And they'll talk about some sledges that today would, you know, might wind up with someone getting fined or banned for a match. But these are part of the legacy and the folklore of the game, which in our minds don't cross the line. We look at other examples from sporting history, like Maradona's Hand of God, for example. Like there are times when there have been clear and blatant breakings of the rules, but which fall into sporting folklore and don't seem to cross the line. And for me, the lesson here is not about let's try and do some really important analytic work to articulate exactly where that line is. It's to show that our immediate response, our immediate ethical judgments are primed in a range of different ways. They have a history to them. They are primed by the kinds of social stories and narratives we receive. They're primed by what we have seen go by before and the extent to which we can compare that to different circumstances, the people who are involved, the way that the people around us respond. There are so many other things that influence the way in which we think about something or reach a judgment. And that's the whole work of, you know, a program like the Vincent Fairfax Fellowship. Like the work that we're trying to do is try to create a space within that for the leader themselves to attend to all of those different forces, to be able to make a judgment around which of those different forces is worth listening to and which of them needs to be kind of screened out and managed against, so that we don't just get caught up in all of these different forces that are pushing us in different directions.
So let's look at what I think is one of the key considerations here. That is the role of certainty in leadership. So it strikes me that because the ethical landscape can be so complex at times, certainty is really elusive. How do good leaders embrace certainty? What's their attitude to certainty, and what does it tell you about their leadership style if they value it above other things?
It's a really good question. You've put your finger on something that I think is really central. There are lots of conversations at the moment around managing uncertainty, risk. And I think the other word that gets thrown in when we're talking about the need for certainty is conversations around vulnerability. And there's lots of leadership work that focuses on vulnerability. But I think we need to be quite nuanced in our thinking around this. There is a kind of vulnerability and there is a kind of uncertainty that we need to get comfortable with, because we can generate enormous issues for ourselves in the desire for certainty. To guarantee particular outcomes, we can jeopardize some people's well-being. We can blind ourselves or overlook or obfuscate the possibility of negative consequences because we're so fixated on the thing that we just want to know for sure, or the one thing that we want to guarantee. And there's conversations happening at the moment in Australia around opening ourselves up to international travel again. And opening our borders. And there is a mindset among some that is like, no, we need absolute certainty. We need to be totally sure that we are not going to have another outbreak, that there's not going to be another phase of this virus that is going to generate lockdowns. And therefore, we are going to be really slow to reopen our borders. Now, that might end up being prudentially the right thing to do. But if it is done, you know, because of this singular focus on avoiding this one thing and guaranteeing that, it kind of falls into the same category as the pursuing victory, where we kind of miss a range of other concerns that we should be attending to. So there is that kind of pursuit of certainty where being comfortable with uncertainty and with the vulnerability that that generates for us, the potential that a choice that we might make may in fact go wrong for reasons that we can't control, it's really important that we do that work. And there are a range of different, you know, movements that are trying to get people to move into that space. Focusing on vulnerability. There's been a revival of a, you know, philosophical school of thought known as Stoicism, which emphasizes the things that people can control. So we're seeing some trends in that direction. However, we need to be really careful as well, because there are a whole lot of things that we shouldn't, and we would be operating badly as leaders if we were just encouraging people to be comfortable with certain kinds of uncertainty. You know, early on in the pandemic, there was an enormous amount of uncertainty. People wanted to know what was happening with their jobs. People wanted to know where they were going to be working. People wanted to know if they were going to be able to take care of their families. There were people who wanted to know if their health was going to be secured. Like, there was an enormous amount of uncertainty. That was the kind of uncertainty that causes enormous amounts of distress and is not existential in nature. It's not just part of the way that we live. That was part of the way in which we structure society. Like, our society is structured so that some people do live very uncertain lives. They are very vulnerable to changes, and there's not an enormous amount that's within their control. And sometimes certainty is a gift that we need to give people. It's something that we owe to people so that they can feel comfortable. And part of the work of leadership is understanding which is which. When do we need people to be comfortable with uncertainty because that is going to be the best way to navigate this path forward? And when are we imposing uncertainty on people, or kind of leaving people in a state of uncertainty because it suits our needs, but actually it's not something that is in their best interest, and it's not necessarily something that we can defend except that it happens to be convenient for us? There are certain kinds of employment. You know, I've got a background within the university sector where there is an enormous reliance on sessional contracts, and where academic staff are often very vulnerable and very uncertain about the future of their employment. That's not necessarily the kind of uncertainty where we need to read some Brené Brown and embrace vulnerability. That's the kind of certainty where we should be working really hard so that, you know, we aren't so reliant on unstable and fleeting and kind of fragile forms of labor, and give people some kind of sense of security and sense of certainty about what's going to happen with their work.
Philanthropy often speaks about the need for collaboration. And in fact, quite often, the best outcomes are driven by collaborative operations and strategies. What does collaborative leadership look like? Because in some ways, it seems to me that it does embrace some of those vulnerabilities that you just referred to.
I mean, I think all leadership involves collaboration, but I think genuinely collaborative leadership challenges that traditional hierarchy that there is the great man of leadership. There is a singular leader, and usually in that concept, it is a man. There is one person who champions the change, who gets the thing done, and then there is a cast of followers around that leader. So we have that kind of idea that there is leadership and then there is followership and there are followers. And a collaborative mindset really challenges the ego of a leader who has been made familiar with that kind of mindset, where an aspect of leadership for them is about the fact that they are the leader. And that can get in the way of any form of meaningful collaboration, because it's not about a common set of needs or a common set of goals. It's about this one person who's in the room and them achieving what they need to achieve so that they feel like the leader that they've always wanted to be. So I think that's the biggest challenge of collaborative leadership, of genuine collaboration, is that we need to let go of, and we're well overdue in terms of letting go of those kinds of mindsets around leadership. I think that the importance of collaboration and the importance of collaborative leadership reveals to us that one of the fundamental traits that a leader requires is humility. And that's not something that we see an enormous amount of when we look to our default ideas about what leadership looks like, and when we look to social narratives around leadership. We elevate certain people as exceptional, and that's what defines them as leaders. And then we kind of put them in environments where they suddenly need to swallow their egos, where they need to be vulnerable, as you say. And that's an incredibly difficult thing for them to do, because they've been told the opposite thing all their life, that they are the best, the brightest, the smartest, the most capable. Mm-hmm. And then they need to kind of quote unquote lower themselves to work with other people. It's just not the way that we should be going about this at all.
Okay, you said not so long ago, the task of leaders in the future is going to be not just how do we use technology to improve our ability to do what we do, but how do we use everything else at our disposal? What does that actually look like?
I think that, you know, this is a really good conversation to have in the context of certainty. One of the things that technology, and I'm thinking really in a very broad way about what technology is a way of taking the world and taking problems and reducing them into bite-sized manageable portions. It brings a certain aspect of the world within our control, and not just within our control, but within our ability to measure it, to use it, to store it, to render it valuable to us and quantifiable. And with that, it empowers, it literally gives us certain power and control over the world around us in a number of different ways. And that can mean that it presents itself as a kind of magic bullet, or at times as a kind of snake oil for problems. So we see leaders and organizations looking to technologies to solve every one of their issues. They look to new processes, they look to new platforms, they bring in consultants to offer them new ways of working. And now ways of working has capital W's in it, right? Because ways of working is a methodology that can be introduced. And these are processes, and these are there are plays, and there are toolkits, and all of those kinds of things that can be great, and they can help people work better together. But when we fixate on technological solutions, because they offer us that kind of certainty, they assure us a kind of control, it can sometimes obfuscate us from seeing what might be better solutions, but which take more work to actually achieve. Certainly, I've made this point in the context of climate change. There are lots of people who look to technology as the thing that is going to solve climate change, new modes of carbon capture, cleaner modes of energy, you know, even the idea of clean coal for some people is a potential solution, like these new technologies, rather than looking at the existing systems that we have, the existing kind of economic business systems, the kinds of ways in which we operate in the world as people, which is quite consumptive, and looking to those things as the things that need to change. So there's always something that offers some kind of magic, comfortable bullet that means that we don't need to deal with the uncertainty, with the discomfort of changing things that make us feel comfortable. And so I think that whenever a technology presents itself that looks like it's going to solve all our problems, I think it's worth asking, why does it look that way to us? Why do we think that this is going to solve all our problems? And if there's one technology that seems like it's going to solve all our problems, it probably wasn't that big an issue to begin with. And then we need to ask, why wasn't it already solved? I think that that's the point, right? Is that you know, technology, it often presents itself too easy. It is absolutely part of the solution. But when we elevate it as we just wait for the new technology, we wait for the new platform to be installed, we're moving to a new website that is going to fix all of our problems. We've all heard these things said in organizations. And of course, they don't do any of those things. They might make some things better, but they don't change the foundational DNA and the foundational challenges that organizations and societies face, because those things weren't technological to begin with.
So if you're a leader in a current environment, whatever kind of organization it is, whether it's a not-for-profit or whether it's a major corporate, where do you place technology as a priority consideration for you in that ethical leadership landscape?
I would be encouraging people not to think about technology as something that needs to be prioritized. I think that technology is only as valuable as it is clear what we are using it for and what we are intending to do with it. Technology in and of itself is not a category that we should be thinking about prioritizing. We should be prioritizing the problems that we need to solve and then asking whether technology has a role to play in solving those problems alongside everything else. If we have problems with communicating with our members as a nonprofit organization, that's the problem that needs to be solved. That's what needs to be given priority. It's not technology that needs to be given priority because it'll give us a new CRM or something like that. We need to know what the problem that we're solving for is before we look to a technology to fix that problem. Once we know what the problems are, then I think, again, like part of the work of leadership is then canvassing for different options, being clear on what the potential solutions are, and then making a prudential and reasoned judgment about which of those is going to work best. Sometimes the technology is going to be the perfect solution. Other times it's going to take a lot more than that. And even if technology is the solution, we need to be attending to the potential side effects of solving a problem by introducing a new technology. Because once you put a technology, something new, into an existing ecosystem, it changes things. If you are moving to remote work, and so suddenly people are communicating more through, you know, messenger platforms or video conferencing or email or whatever it is, you have changed fundamentally the nature of the organization, the nature of the relationships and the connections there. It's not just about the technology, it's about everything that exists around that.
One final question, Matt. If you were constructing an ethical toolkit for the modern leader, what would you put in it?
Well, it looked like a 12-month course called the Vincent Fairfax Fellowship that's run at the Crown Lana Center for Ethical Leadership. Thank you for the plug. My sense is that the greatest ethical challenges arise because people don't actually realize that they are facing an ethical challenge to begin with. Their way of operating in the world, their understanding of the environment that they're in, is so normalized, so familiar, and so deeply ingrained that the challenges that emerge don't seem like challenges to them. They just seem like another process, another way of doing things. So a lot of the work that we begin with within the VFF, within the program, is working with leaders to help them to see and accurately diagnose an ethical issue, not just to go like, something doesn't feel right here, or there might be an ethical problem here, but get to the core of what makes it an ethical problem and whose ethical problem it is. And too often when we think about ethical problems, we think about something new or something that is out of the ordinary. And the first piece of work that we do at the VFF is to help people to try to articulate and see whether or not there is something in their ordinary environment, in the everyday, in the boring stuff, that itself gives rise to ethical challenges. Because there are often ordinary practices that we are super comfortable with and super familiar with that themselves give rise to some of the largest challenges we face. And so for me, the starting point is going to be there. There is an enormous amount of work that goes into that, but I think a lot of it is about being able to actually recognize the world around us as it really is, in its full complexity and in its full messiness. And to your point, you know, be comfortable with the vulnerability and uncertainty that that generates. For me, any kind of toolkit needs to start with the ability to actually recognize the world around it for the fullness of what it is, and not to narrow it in some way because that's the way that we're used to processing problems, or that's the way that our organization tends to do it, or because we are focused on a particular stakeholder's concerns or a particular problem that we need to solve. We need to have a real breadth to the way in which we're operating.
That was Dr. Matthew Beard, the new program director of the Vincent Fairfax Fellowship at the Crane-Lana Centre for Ethical Leadership. This has been the Philanthropy Australia podcast. I'm Nick Richardson, and thanks for listening.